Well, good afternoon and welcome. This is the House Energy Committee, and it will now come to order. The time is 1:03 on Tuesday, March 25th. Present at this time are Representative Costello, Representative Tilton, Representative Rauscher, Co-Chair Representative Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Kai Holland. So thank you for joining us today. So we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. I'll also note that we're allowing the use of electronic devices during committee meetings. Just a reminder that staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Shana Kilcoyne, and she'll take care of it and help you with that. Importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, our House Energy Secretary up here in the front, and Zach Lawhorn, who's in the back from the Juneau LIO. He's always here, but glad to see him for this meeting and the support for this meeting. Today we'll be focusing in on rural issues around energy. We've got four presenters today to represent various geographies and concerns. Our first and final speakers will be calling in remotely. Just like to note, I appreciate the time and the effort for our presenters today. We've had a lot of presentations over the previous meetings that have looked at the rail belt energy issues, and we've looked at the rural energy issues. We've tended, though, to look at it a little more technically from the standpoint of the power producers, the rail belt and transmission operators, and the regulations that were developed in the last session that looked at the Rail Belt Reliability Council and those pieces of the structure of it. And this opportunity came together with the coordination with all of you to bring a little more of a community lens to these issues, so that when we're talking about energy, we need to realize at the end of the day, we're really concerned about what's happening in the communities and what are the challenges the communities are facing as a result of our efforts to try and produce power. So you bring a really vital, necessary lens to our discussions, and it'll be important as we move forward in the next few weeks with some of the legislation that we have that community perspective of these issues, not just the technical perspective of power plants and transmission lines and regulations over that. So thank you for joining us today. With that, we'll kick off the discussion today with Ben Mallott. Ben is the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I understand he will be joining us remotely. Are you on, Mr. Mallott? Sounds good. Is that, are we expecting that going to be brief or?
It will be brief.
Okay. Well, let's continue on then, I guess, if that's okay, makes sense. Thank you. So let's, if we can, let's jump down to our second presenter, Andrew Guy, who's president of Calista Corporation. And Mr. Guy, if you're available to start off at the beginning, sorry for the surprise of the order switch.
Do I sit here?
Yes, please. So if you would approach the bench there and you could introduce yourself for the record. And I think your presentation is already set up on the computer for you to be able to move the slides, or we can assist you in there. But
Can somebody slide or move the slides for me, please?
Yes, that would be
fine.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Shana, if you can help with the slides when we're ready. Thank you. Very good. So if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin, please.
I'm Andrew Guy, the president and CEO of Calista Corporation. I've been in this position going on 15 years. Prior to that, I was the general counsel for the company for 15 years. Prior to that, I was on the board of directors for 6 years. And prior to that, I was an intern and an employee. So I've been with the company for 40 or so years. Calista represents the Waikiki Delta area of this region, I mean the state. We have about 38,500 shareholders, so it's a very big region. AGSA, in terms of energy, was the impetus for utilities to be formed in our communities. And I watched that happen. Prior to AGSA, you know, we had our own family generators. We turn them on, crank them up, in the evening and turn them off again in the evening. They weren't running full time. It was only after ANCSA was enacted and the corporations were formed that utilities for the whole villages were implemented by the village corporations primarily. And I watched it happen. You know, village corporations had to have energy for stores and freezers and, you know, to do their work. So that's how utilities began in the communities in my region, at least. Right now we have a mixture of ownership and operators. Many of our communities are operated by their own village corporations still, but very few. Many of them just because of the fact of the highly regulated industry that utilities are, transferred those operations to either municipalities or tribes and nonprofits like AVEC. So that's the state of the energy situation in the Waikiki Delta now. You know, we've been in a crisis for a long time, and it's no longer even considered a crisis. And that's not a very good position to be in. You know, with my involvement with Calista, I know that we've been working on energy for a long time. You know, I know we started working on energy when I was an intern. I listened to the discussions back then. As a board member, I listened to the reports by our staff on what they were trying to accomplish in terms of solving the energy issue. So we do have a lot of history with trying to solve energy among ourselves. If we can move on. In that first slide, I wanted to point out that Bethel is 400 miles away from here, Anchorage. So in the whole region, we run from probably roughly 300 to 500 miles away from here. So that's a pretty far distance. But I'll get to a point later where it's not really that far. In the Waikiki Delta, in this slide, you can see how much we pay. One community we have here, Sleep Mute, pays those kilowatt hours, and gas prices are way up there, and stove oil prices, too, for heating. You know, compared to urban Alaska, 22 cents, that's a really major, major difference. I was on the State Energy Security Task Force a couple of years ago, and the goal there was 10 cents a kilowatt hour for the whole state. I told the governor and his folks that I didn't want to be a participant unless real progress would be made in terms of solving energy for the whole state, not just the rail belt, you know, and the southeast. And PCE was not supposed to be a permanent kind of fix. Talking with the prior legislatures that represented rural Alaska, the leadership of the times, they understood that it was a temporary solution. With the state to be coming in with a permanent fix like they done with the southeast and the rail belt energy situations. Unfortunately, the situation with the oil prices came in the 80s, you know, the tank and the economy being what it is back then. That, I think, kind of threw off everybody, and everybody kind of forgot the purpose of PCE and the promise that had been made to rural Alaska that it would be not be a permanent fix. So this is the point I wanted to make on this particular slide. PCE is not the solution that we should be relying on going forward. It was never supposed to be the solution that it is right now. Thank you. On this particular page, you can see a picture of the tank farm, and this is symbolic of, you know, many of the tank farms that we have in all of our communities. In the Waikea Delta, we have 19 electric utility providers for our 50 communities. So that tells you a lot of our villages are run by individual operators in each village. So no economy of scale, and they're not able to get particular expertise developed, you know, for each community. It's pretty hard to live in those communities. You know, I go back to my village in the Neposkak, and many times I spend a summer there. And the situation there is not something that we should be living with in this day and age. You know, we have too many issues with the generators coming on, off and on, brownout situations that affects our lights and our freezers, refrigerators. And in some communities, they totally lose power for several weeks. And that really impacts not just the daily necessities, but like education, you know, when they can't go to school. So this kind of situation cannot be acceptable. You know, it's not acceptable to us, and it should not be acceptable to the legislature that we have in the administration. In development opportunities, you know, we need to develop interties. We have many communities that are close together, and yet they're not intertied. So we can't take advantage of the efficiencies that come with being part of a big group. You know, when you look at the lower 48, it's divided into four energy districts, and they're all intertied. Here in Alaska, we only have the rail belt intertied from Homer up to Fairbanks, 700 miles. You know, I mentioned earlier that Bethel is 400 miles away. Bristol Bay is only probably 100 miles from Homer. And yet we have not made any effort to intertie like the Bristol Bay, Waikea Delta, and other rural areas. That needs to happen. You know, we have sources of power that can contribute to the intertie too. You know, several years ago, we began the effort to develop the Chikumnuk Hydro Power Project. And we went all the way to the FERC stage. And then, you know, with the support of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and BLM, and we were stopped at the legislature here. The House did not enact legislation to allow hydropower to be developed at that particular lake, even though the two lakes beneath it were authorized to do that. And they were salmon spawning. And the reason why we chose the Chikumnuk was because it was not a salmon spawning. And there are other sites in the region that can be developed, but because of our stand on salmon, the reliance we have on salmon, we deliberately chose did not select those for any development, only Chikumnuk. We've taken a look at many energy sources. One source was a coal-fired plant, but back then our folks didn't want it because of the fear of black lung disease. I don't know how the situation now is in terms of the technology to have clean coal power. But the one thing about that was when we went through the whole process of getting to the stage of looking at and developing a coal-fired plant, we found that we needed to export coal from Australia. It would have been cheaper, cleaner to get coal from Australia than from here in Alaska, even from our own region. We do have some coal in our region, but it's not of a quality that I guess Australia has. So we need to remind ourselves of that, considering the low 48 situation where every community is intertied along those four major parts. In Alaska, we can do that too, not just intertie the rail belt, but extend it out to rural Alaska. In this particular slide, in this gas pipeline, you know, to really spur economic and business development, we need a source of power that's dependable for bigger projects. And this is one source that can make that happen. So if this project is going to go, you know, I hope the legislature reminds itself that rural Alaska needs to be a part of that project, because we can use it to develop projects that can never become feasible with the situation that we have. At Jalista, we have a gold prospect, Dahlin. Mm-hmm. And the you know, it's been 30 years, coming on 30 years since we began that project with the two operators that we have. If it had been anywhere near the road system and a power source, it would have been up and running already. That tells you the critical need for a major power source like a gas pipeline can bring to the region. And then we have other sources of, you know, other project possibilities that can never become feasible because we don't have a power source for it. So that's the one point that I wanted to bring up on this gas pipeline. And that's the extent of my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Guy. And I know I've got a couple questions for you here. I expect there may be some other questions here. But I'm also aware that because we switched the order, Mr. Malott only has a few more minutes. So with your patience and indulgence, we're going to switch to allow Mr. Malott to have a few minutes while he's available. And then we're going to come back to the presentations and some questions for you. So is that okay that we kind of move the order around? And thank you for the committee members for this kind of little juggle that we're doing at the moment there. So, Mr. Malott, if I understand you may be on at this point on Teams. And if you could come up, we would appreciate a few minutes of your time. But I know that it's limited.
Awesome. Thank you. And I apologize about the mix-up. I had the wrong Teams link. I was kind of sitting there listening to music, waiting for the start. So I apologize for the mix-up there. Representative Mears, Representative Hahn, thank you for hosting this hearing. And also, Andrew Guy, thank you for leadership in this area. Your leadership, just the leadership in the YK region, has really been valuable in expanding rural energy and also expanding our own self-determination in expanding energy for how we support our communities. I'm going to real quick. I want to thank this committee again for hosting this hearing, and it's critical. This hearing and kind of a part of this came out of a resolution passed at the 2024 AFM convention, resolution 2412, that calls for advancing energy sovereignty and security in rural Alaska communities. I don't want to speak in double, and you heard it from Andrew, just how important energy is for rural communities. Energy and having sustainable and stable energy is critical for sustainability of our communities, not only for our communities, but also for rural Alaska and also our traditional cultural life. So much of our livelihood now is based on energy, having stable and affordable energy, not only for food security, for having freezers to hold and freeze our meat, but also for stores to have, you know, economic, activity. Broadband, right? Broadband has been rapidly brought out to rural Alaska. You can have broadband on the internet. That affects our schools. That affects how our communities in rural Alaska, how our tribes, how our ANCs, tribal organizations can be a bigger part of the world. Right, so as the AFM, as the delegates pass this resolution, last year, 2412, it passed unanimously. It didn't have any amendments. This is how critical this issue is for our communities to have stable energy and also reliable and affordable energy as well. I was talking to my niece recently in Yakta. Yakta's weekend has experienced 8 power outages in one weekend. It actually fried her dryer. So not only does that, you know, impact their weekend, in fact, it also now means that my niece has to get a new dryer shipped to Yakta, which isn't cheap, right? So not only are, having, inconveniences in the rural Alaska, but also having really hard economic hardships on our communities and also our tribal members that live in rural Alaska. Andrew mentioned it earlier that, when you do have power outages, you have to use backup generators. That's really expensive for our communities, right? Also, for a tribe or a community that buys fuel twice a year, right? You got to also account for that too. But if you run out of fuel, then you need more fuel for a community to fly in. Resolution 2412 also recognizes that, Akiak had a 52-day power outage, right? As a whole community, 52 days without power. That wouldn't be okay in rural Alaska or in urban Alaska or rural 48, right? So the ability for our communities to have adequate, reliable, and affordable energy is critical. And so I just want to, bring attention to that resolution. It did pass last year, unanimous consent. This is a critical issue for our communities, especially as we, discuss out-migration of rural Alaska, having affordable energy and for abilities for our tribes and ANCs to have that economic backbone is critical. And I really want to thank Andrew and the rest of the witnesses today. They are the feet on the ground. Andrew works with his communities every day, so is Kowarik. And so I want to thank them for having the time here today and actually sharing the feet on the ground and sources what happens to our communities when we don't have this reliable power that urban Alaska benefits from. I also want to say a couple of things too. We've had many reports, many task force, and right now we're at the time where we want to get things done. And, our communities have the capacity to get things done. ANCHC, Kowarik, Manitic, all of our tribal organizations, Shanista, our ANCs have amazing capacity to work on this. So we can ask you to work with our communities, work with us, because we know what's best for our communities. So with that said, I'm going to end my comments there. Gunakshish, Koyana, for having this hearing. I just want to thank Andrew and the rest of the witnesses today for sharing the firsthand feet on the ground experiences of what of what the impacts of having a non-stable, non-reliable, non-affordable energy grid in rural Alaska impacts our communities and tribal sovereignty.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Rollett. Any of you have questions for Ms. Rollett? I'm wondering if in the resolution there's a number of recommendations that I saw there. I was wondering if there's any in particular you'd like to ask us to be focusing in on at this point in time of those recommendations. I know there were some that related to the different regulatory bodies. There were some that looked at the energy assistance funding and approaches there. There was a recommendation around a rural Alaska Energy Sovereignty Task Force, and there's quite a bit there. I'm just wondering if there's, a focus you might have of a couple of those areas that you think are timely and critical for us to make sure we put some time into trying to advance those.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I appreciate it. Through the chair of mind, I think the Tribal Sovereignty Task Force is critical, not only to, have another report, have another task force, but to really ensure that those in rural Alaska, like Andrew, like Kowarik, and others that actually know how rural Alaska works, to actually have their voices in the process. In the past, it seems like you've had a lot of engineers and scientists kind of tell communities what works, what doesn't work. But as Andrew knows, we know what works best for our community. So I think having a task force that really is led by rural Alaskans in this is, will be critical. In that also, having ideas of how state and federal government can work better together in terms of how we could get resources to the ground in a more efficient way? What, you know, what can be tied with federal funding currently that can't be tied with state funding? So I think there is a federal component here. I think a task force that looks at those and looks at opportunities that our tribes actually have ability to go for federal funding in different ways, plus money that the state might not be able to. So I think there's a lot that a rural tribal task force could do to kind of, you know, identify efficiencies and kind of what works and what doesn't work in rural Alaska and start from there.
All right. Thank you. Co-Chair Mears, did you have a question?
No, I was just running on your timing.
Oh, I thank you. And Mr. Rollins, and you just have to let me know when your time is up, because otherwise I could.
Well, I'm good.
I could suck you into some other things. I'm curious if you could pick up, because there's a question I had for Mr. Guy that I'll come back to when we can. But I want to take advantage of you being here, because through the AFN you have kind of a balcony view. Mr. Guy made the comment about the PCE was really not intended to be a forever kind of structure. Not quite your words, but in my mind. And, you know, as I've experienced and I'm new to this issue, I've been kind of told to kind of stay away from messing with PCE, that's a challenging topic to bring up because it's so important for so many communities right now. And there's a concern that if we start making some changes to it, that we might threaten it. And I'm curious, Mr. Mallott, kind of what your view is of how we might think about the PCE and a pathway towards supporting projects in rural communities that would move us towards that vision that it might not be necessary someday in the future if we invested correctly to do that. What's your view of the path that we can do that without immediately being told, no, this is kind of too hard, don't touch it?
That's a really good question, and you know, I think Andrew is right. PCE right now is a lifeline for so many in rural Alaska that can't keep the playing field somewhat even though it does have its flaws. There's a lot of opportunity there with PCE. In terms of your request that it was just a temporary program, I don't know I remember how Adam started, and he's a good friend of my dad, so it wasn't, I think I was in middle school, high school when that passed through, but I think the intent of PCE was to be that band-aid and kind of, level the playing field until rural Alaska can catch up with urban Alaska in terms of having a modern, affordable, stable power grid. And so I think, you know, as you look at the themes, I would encourage, you know, not to mess too much around with PCE in terms of its immediate impact for our communities. The larger discussion of what Andrew can raise of what efficiencies could be done right now in rural Alaska, such as interties, what technology work, what technology doesn't work, could be identified and used. So hopefully that, you know, as those programs and energy projects get put in place, you know, communities would hopefully not rely so much on PCE, and you know, it'll come back to, you know, having an equal playing field. Kind of my initial thoughts right now.
Great, thank you, Representative Rauscher. Did you have a question or a comment tonight?
Yeah, maybe just a comment. My understanding is, you know, PCE is an endowment and it's standalone, and we're only working on a certain percentage, 5% or whatever it is, and then there's a trickle down. And in that trickle down, it gets to where you're talking about projects that may benefit the overall scheme of things, to where there are projects coming to the rural communities which will help lower the cost for energy. And I think that's already incorporated in that process. The only way to do it any differently would be to change the percentage, and I don't think that's healthy. The percentage would have to go up, and that would risk the endowment. This is just all speaking personally. So I think that to mess with it at all is kind of a tricky situation, to where you could be end up doing more harm than good in the long run, even though the short idea of being able to provide for projects now may not benefit the long endurance of it itself. That's just a personal opinion.
Great. Thank you. I need to take just a quick at ease for a moment.
end up putting money into it all the time.
You guys ready?
Instead of an endowment that survives on its own.
Yeah. We're back on the record. We'll continue this conversation officially on the record. Co-chair Holland had to step out for a bill presentation briefly, so I've got the gavel shortly. Mr. Mallott, do you have any closing comments? Because I recognize that you've got another appointment coming up as well.
No, I just want to thank you again for your leadership. I want to thank Andrew's leadership on this. And I think this is a really valuable discussion, especially as we look at the future of our state and how we also, you know, tackle out-migration, because it's really all connected. So I'm going to choose Koyana. Happy answering questions, and I thank you for this hearing.
Thank you, and it's a good reminder to occasionally take a look at those AFN resolutions as we do our work down here in the legislature. Thank you. So, Mr. Guy, I think there are some questions. I think Representative Rauscher, did you have a question as well?
I made a statement.
Okay.
Thank you.
I know you guys were chatting just as we were coming back on the record.
Small talk.
Excellent. Well, and I believe some of that small talk generated when that relationship from working on the Energy Task Force. Representative Holland wanted to know if you had any thoughts from that process, where we're at, and knew anything like you'd like to see continue to happen from that report and those recommendations.
Well, Madam Chair, when I participated in that task force, I continually educated the members about the ANCSA promise or the ANCSA agreement. You know, with the ANCSA, originally it had been a termination act, but it was changed from a termination act into a real deal shortly thereafter. With the 1991 amendments, and with that came the, ANCSA took away our living, with the expectation that our people would start getting jobs in the Western way, and that meant infrastructure development, which the state and the feds were supposed to take the lead in. You know, when you look at Western history, nothing happens without infrastructure development, which is the obligation of the government. In our case, that has never happened. And that's why we've been in this crisis for such a long time, because the state and the feds have broken their agreement, like many times they've done before. You know, it's our history, United States history, and unfortunately Alaska history too. It's time we came together and started coming into solutions so that our agreements are lived up to, so that, through ANCSA, we can make strides in terms of business development. Business development where our people can have jobs, and not just our people, but everybody else in the state of Alaska. We need to have that happen. And we need to be part of the solution and not be left behind. That's the kind of education that I was bringing forward to the task force members, many of whom did not have that history nor know about the kind of agreements that had been made back then. So it was a learning experience for not only myself but task members. But the big point about participating in that task force was not to be part of a process where nothing happened at the end. You know, we've been studied to death. We've had too many studies that sit on the gathering dust. And we can't keep on living like that anymore. You know, I know it's part of your system to be doing that, but you need to break out of it. You know, in my culture, we have a term, "singinak," not to be doing anything in vain. You know, living in the culture, in the environment that we've had for millennia, we couldn't be doing stuff in vain. And our Alaska legislature and the U.S. government have to kind of break out of their system and start coming up with real solutions. Not doing stuff in vain, more studies and more studies and more studies. We don't need that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think some of the collaboration and relationships that we gain along some of these processes are useful. I appreciate you and Representative Rauscher having a connection from that and now with us here on the committee and sharing some of that. And I appreciate the reminder, too, of all the work that's done at AFN to put those resolutions together as well. So the collaboration is an important part of that process as well as the report. So thank you for sharing those. Do you have any other final comments?
No, but I want to thank you and the committee members for allowing me to make a presentation today. You know, on the brownout situation I mentioned earlier and when our generators fail, another added cost is our freezers and refrigerators and other stuff that rely on that energy to be running all the time. They break down a lot faster. So that adds to the cost of the living out in rural Alaska, where shipping doubles kind of every, the price of everything that we bring out there.
Thank you. And early on in my career, I had the fortune to be an engineer with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium working on water and sewer and, sanitation infrastructure projects. So recognizing the importance of, electricity to be able to run those systems as well, which is important to public health. So thank you very much for your time today. I'm very glad that you could be here. Welcome back to Representative Holland, but I think we'll kick off the presentation and then I'll hand the gavel back. So next up, we will hear from Wayne Morgan, Special Projects Coordinator for Antioch Traditional Council. Mr. Morgan, we've got you here. Thank you very much. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Okay, I'm Wayne Morgan. I'm with the Antioch Traditional Council and I deal with special projects, and amongst the many titles I've had before in committees and board meetings, the greatest one I appreciate now is my tribe has named me as their traditional chief, which is a great honor. So that's something I hold close. I'm going to talk to you on, I wouldn't be repetitive, but I thank Mr. Guy and Mr. Malak with their presentation, so that'll lead a little more in depth what I'm going to present today. And Antioch Traditional Council is the sponsor of the resolution that Mr. Malott has brought up. So you're looking at the person that wrote out the resolution. I'm very glad that the AFN has supported that move, and they even added a new position within their organization, someone that deals with energy. So I'm very glad with that. So again, good afternoon. I'll share with you back in 2023 what happened in Antioch because of no oversight, no state protections, which there are state protections and statute and laws that didn't protect us at the time. So I'll go to the next slide. Antioch, small hub. Hub to 15 villages, we have about 500 people. So it's a hub. We have our local school district located there. Airlines, the cargo airlines that come in from Anchorage. So we do get NAC and Everett's and, freight flew in there. Next one, please. Antioch is run by privately owned utility, and it's family owned, and it sits on restricted property, so allotment, restricted land. Okay, I'll just share with you, back in 2023, this is a slide that shows in January, pretty much, January, December, that's what we're paying during winter time. This is my current bill, so I use not so much energy, I would say. But at that time, $0.51 before PCE kicks in. $0.51 is the cost per kilowatt. And COPA, you know, cost of power adjustment was $0.07. So I would say this is about average. So there, you know, residential areas, you know, households like mine pay anywhere from this to about $200, probably more than that. So we'll go to the next slide. So that's a January one. Again, this is another slide showing more light. I mean, it's like now, April 1st. So a little more daylight and, you know, less energy use. So during that month, it's 47 cents before PCE. And COPA was up to 15 cents of that. Okay. Without public notice, without notices to residential customers, that's required, right? With any kind of rate increase proposed. This was approved by RCA. Your RCA Board of Commissioners approved this. And this was from my recollection investigation into it. They approved it that January, okay, and it took effect come June, right? Okay, $1.87 before PCE. Cost of power adjustment was $1.46 of that. That's why. Okay, why did that happen? Not supposed to happen, right? And this is in June. Okay, I'll go. I'll show you another one next. Again, next month, the July, same thing, right? $1.87. Disconnect if you know you don't pay it off, right? And this was within all our residential customers. So why did this happen again? So we written to the governor. Dunleavy, also to the RCA, wanting some answers. And we have been held some meetings with RCA and saying, how did this happen? Why did this get approved? Right? They're supposed to be the ones who watch over us customers in preventing this from happening. Without, again, public notice. Right? Outrageous. I'll go to the next. Okay, this is the notice we got from the power company. So, apologizing, saying that they messed up. They didn't do the COPA like they're supposed to be doing it the year before. But essentially, this is saying we have to do this again, which was approved by RCA. Our, like I said, our letter to the governor. And the fix was a for that. This was like $450,000 to $500,000, not included by the utility that they should have over the past year. So they wanted us to pay it in 3 months. So the RCA and the governor's fix was amortize it over 2 years. So essentially financing that payment, us paying that over 2 years. We got another maybe 4 more months of these increased payments. Go to the next. And this is the present bill today. With that, you know, I said finance so amortized for 2 years. It's 94 cents. That's our current kilowatt hour we pay for. And of that, you know, the COPA increase is included in that. And if you notice these bills that I showed you, costs, PCE, if it wasn't for PCE, we'd be paying that whole amount, which PCE is paying, you know, a lot for that. Or that RCA judgment on us. So that's something, you know, like you heard the comments about PCE, but I'm thankful for PCE. Otherwise, we'd be stuck with this bill. Think about these, like our school district is located there. We have a K-12 school. We have a district office there, and we got a maintenance shop and a hangar, just in Aniak alone. Their normal bill during that time, like I showed you at the beginning, was $7,000 to $9,000 for those buildings over a month, right? $7,000 to $9,000 cost. That'd be normal. Like I showed you the increase, what we experienced, $1.87. You know, they're not covered by PCE. That month alone was $24,000 for that month, and they have to pay it. They had to pay it. That cost, $24,000, is what they would pay for the school district cost for a month. So right now they're paying 94 cents straight up from what it used to be, like I showed you, 49 cents. 47. So their costs are doubled from over the last couple of years. So that, you know, they have to take away programs from the kids because of those costs. Next slide. A notice came out. I'll just share with you on Facebook within this last month. On Facebook. Because of lack of maintenance and infrastructure improvements to the utility, because it's privately owned. This is a notice that we got within a couple days before that we had to go out to our meter, take a picture, and send it to them. Otherwise, you get estimated costs. So I would say half of our residential home customers didn't see this. So when that happens, they estimate, and then they bill you sometimes 2 to 3 months for that you would have to cover and pay for right up front rather than monthly. So is there another slide after this? No? Okay. So within that, you heard before, and you heard Mr. Ballot, and this is something I pushed for, is rural representation must be needed for these kind of things to prevent them from happening to communities like Aniak, right? Not supposed to happen. RCA is within their laws and regulations that they have protections in there they didn't even follow. And I know that if we had someone that has rural perspective sitting on being part of, like RCA, to prevent these kind of things from happening. What is a fix? A start, maybe? Rural Energy Task Force? A start? And look into operations of, like, what RCA is supposed to be doing in their operations. As you know, they're run by people appointed by the governor, right? They're appointed, and they run the organization. You have one chairman that's in charge of the whole operations. Maybe a fix would be someone that's professional, where commissioners make the decision, but they have someone to put forth that recommended decision to them, make it approved. Because you do have law judges working within that organization, engineers working in that organization, and you have professionals that are supposed to be doing what's not supposed to happen in Aniak. So Rural Energy Task Force is a start, I would say.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Morgan. I'd like to acknowledge that Representative and Speaker Edgman arrived here a few minutes ago during the presentation, so thank you for joining us.
Yes, and I want to say, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm sorry I couldn't be here. I was upstairs, and engaged in another meeting that spilled over, so I really apologize for not being here, but I'm familiar, Wayne, with your concern. You and I talked about that this past October in Antioch, and well noted.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I add?
Yes, please.
And like you heard from Mr. Malott and also Mr. Guy, you know, energy sovereignty is and security is needed in, you know, throughout our state. You heard the gas prices, that it's almost $10 a gallon and the price of fuel almost $10. How do we subsidize that cost? We get freezers. We store our food, you know, to subsidize that high cost of, you know, fuel so we could live off of the what we gather. In my household, I have two freezers, so that, you know, got to be nearly full by fall time to carry me through the winter months into the next fishing season. So that's just, you know, something that urban residents don't, you know, some, right, don't get to experience that. That's what we do out in rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. So,
good point. Thank you. Representative?
Yeah. Not in response, but just, I guess, to note that 3 years ago, we increased the benefits from the power cost equalization program from 500 kilowatt-hour rates to 750 kilowatt-hour rates, kilowatts per residential user. And it's really interesting because the PC report came out a couple weeks ago from Alaska Energy Authority, and the per-usage amount really has increased out in those 88 communities that partake in the PC environment. So, you know, partially a fix, I guess you could say, but it doesn't address the overall how expensive. When I was out in Antioch, of course, everything is super expensive and getting more expensive by the, you know, by the day, it seems like. But I would also point out that this is also a good plug for the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program, and I hope that we can not lose sight of that as well.
Good. Thank you. I wonder, Mr. Morgan, if you could share with us a little bit about the energy sovereignty. I saw that in the resolution, the AFN resolution, and it's an interesting idea, but I wonder if you might share a little bit more about what that means to you and what it might mean to the work we need to do, the policies that might take us in that direction. I'm curious about it because we have some of these structures like PCE that kind of lock us into the way the world is right now and makes it kind of hard to make changes. And energy sovereignty suggests a vision of moving to a different relationship with energy, but I'd love to hear in your words what that energy sovereignty is and what we might be doing that takes us in the direction of seeing that.
Okay, I'll just share with you with what our tribe is currently doing. Energy sovereignty. Our tribe is working towards and trying to secure, even though during this new administration within our government with, you know, making lots of cuts, but our tribe is looking at renewable energy, right? Like solar. Solar would work the best for ANIA. So our tribe is trying to secure grant funding to have a large-scale solar project with a battery backup. To that, we would still have to work with the local utility because we'd have to create a IPP, right, power purchase agreement with them. The other part is energy sovereignty. Our tribe is also looking at creating our own utility, diesel generator, right, trying to address that on our own, pursuing that on our own, but we, it comes to rural communities to raise that, right, do that on their own. When there's power outages for many days, it's up to that community without any state help to pursue that on their own to address that. Energy sovereignty is having that security, right? Food security, like you mentioned, that'll address our food security throughout. If ENIAC can do it, then other areas can also pursue that same like projects that we're pursuing, which some are, right? Some are on their own with wind. So energy sovereignty is having us, doing that on our own, but it shouldn't be just us doing that. We should have some oversight within, maybe to start within this energy committee, ensuring how would that look. And you heard energy, Rural Energy Task Force might be there to help with that, ensuring these kind of things don't happen in rural Alaska.
Great, thank you. Follow up to that, otherwise I'm going to go a slightly different direction.
Well, I was just thinking that through the chair, back to our presentation from Curtis Thayer with Alaska Energy Authority, there is a task force that's guiding the Alaska Energy Authority right now. You know, they've created their own board through that same bill, House Bill 307, that reconfigured those RCA seats that we talked about last session. And there could be more rural representation on that board. I think there's a member from Kotzebue, if I recall, and maybe a member from Cordova, but there isn't really from Western Alaska, you know, per se. I mean, Kotzebue's Northern Alaska. But that would be a good place to start in terms of getting that voice heard. You know, we've had the Alaska Energy Authority before the committee and looking at their whole suite of projects, bulk fuel, revolving loan fund, circuit rider program, the management of the PC program, renewable energy grant fund, things like that. And but a tricky part right now is that a lot of their federal funding, it's over $100 million, is frozen at the moment. And maybe some of it's been unfrozen since Director Thayer was here. But it's... I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, battery storage technology has really improved. Solar power is, you know, I got to tour in Bethel the solar panels that Tim Myers have in his farm. He's got a crank. He adjusts them whenever the sun goes down or, you know, the days get short in wintertime. But he powers his entire farm off of those two solar panels. So, yeah, that should be more present in communities like ENIAC that gets a lot of exposure and a lot of sun.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Mr. Morgan, I was curious to get your view on the, I'm not sure how to ask this. The ENIAC has a private utility providing power, which seems perhaps unusual, given my understanding of many of the other AVAC communities I'm a little more familiar with that are co-ops and other locally owned structure. I'm curious how ENIAC ended up with a private utility and whether that has come out of a situation that was advantageous, that was the good and has been a good way to do it, or was there something different that created the situation that caused the utility to be set up privately versus in a member-owned co-op or other structure? What's kind of your view of the history and what's worked well with that structure and what maybe needs to be changed? You've mentioned that maybe some tribal-related generation plans in the future, which suggests you maybe are moving away from the current structure.
I would, in my experience and learning, go beyond me, privately owned, but it was... I would say was well run when it was run correctly, like it should. You heard me say at the beginning is, you know, lack of maintenance and infrastructure upgrades would be costing the millions to upgrade the current utility to up to standard, right? That's a RCA question too, I would say. They hold a permit, right? They could pull that permit. They could have an audit done within any utility in the state of Alaska in operations. Was that done in Enya? Not to this day that I know of. It's a review. I think ensuring, you know, maybe this committee could look into ensuring the RCA is doing an annual review of utilities and having a report out to you here in this energy committee, giving a report out to your organization to ensure that they are following their laws and regulations that, you know, that impose on them that they have to follow, which in ENIAC's case didn't follow. It missed all these prevention where it has a pass-through, right? One person doesn't say, this is good, pass it. It got to go through separate people to ensure it's can be approved by the Board of Commissioners.
So thank you for that. The last thing I wanted to ask about, you've actually already maybe anticipated, or maybe I anticipated where you're going to go, is the role of RCA. Because you mentioned early on that there were some checks and controls that might have caught this much earlier. And you've just mentioned a couple in terms of RCA's role and perhaps auditing or reviewing that. I'm just wondering if we can go back to your earlier comments about the RCA and other oversight that might have prevented the problem. And I wonder if you might point out for us, just in summary, what one or two of those checks or steps might have been that would have highlighted that something needed to be done before it got to the point where there was this large cost that had to get passed on. What got missed? What needed to have happened a year or two ago that might have changed the trajectory of what happened?
I would, my opinion, Mr. Chair, is you have professional staff working for the commissioners within RCA. That, you know, had to make recommendations to the Board of Commissioners, right? RCA. How did that process didn't happen? Was it a meeting that, a short meeting where I'm just throwing out some things where, like meeting here, it got, motion was made and rubber stamp. There was a lot of failures before that happened. That would be an RCA question. That would be finding out what that organization does. Mr. Chair, I also, like Representative Edgman spoke to his qualifications for Board of Commissioner for RCA. A year ago, I did put my name in the hat for being consideration under those until the qualification was amended last year through this legislature, which was not, I followed that with the qualifications right now, I wouldn't be qualified for that seat. I followed that bill all the way through till the floor. That's where it got passed on the floor. But within committees, it was not recommended to have that qualification inserted in there until the vote on the floor happened. That's where business gets done, correct? That'll be an RCA question.
Thank you for providing that response. I know that I'm touching on some complicated topics, so I do appreciate the feedback you're giving us. Representative Mears or Co-Chair Mears?
Thank you. We certainly try and get most of our work done in committees before things hit to the floor. But yeah, all of a sudden things can dramatically change once we get there. So I just wanted to note that there are three RCA commissioner positions that are up for appointment now. The three commissioners were in front of both of us and other committees last week, and very broadly their qualifications are in accounting, engineering, and law. And they all have got an energy focus, which I think really speaks to a recognition that this is a very broad issue that is in front of them. Of course, there's many other things and other utilities that the RCA deals with, but I think, and then all three of them have come on board in the past several months, less than a year for the three of them. So I think we're going to see some changes in new energy coming from there. And we've had the RCA in front of this committee. We had commissioners last week, and I think we're not done with our relationship with the RCA. So
we're not done.
thank you very much for being here, for sharing your perspective. You know, we joke that when somebody has a good argument, they bring receipts. You have done that quite literally, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Morgan.
Thank you.
Our final presenter today is Amanda Tordahl. Amanda is the Community Planning and Development Program Director for Kuwarik. Ms. Tordahl, if you're on there, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and looking forward to your additional contribution to our discussion today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak today. Making sure everyone can hear all right?
We can hear you okay. If it's possible for you to be a little closer to the microphone or speak up, we might hear you a little bit better, but it's okay.
All right, I'll try and turn this up a little bit. Is that better? My name is Amanda Tordahl, and I am the Community Planning and Development Program Director for Kuwarik. Kuwarik serves the Bering Strait region, and you'll see on the first slide that you have in front of you, the Bering Strait region is home to just under 10,000 people, of which 75% are Alaska Native. And at Kuwarik, we serve 20 tribes in the region. These 20 tribes are split out over 16 communities, which are powered by 15 islanded microgrids. These are all diesel power plants, and there are only two communities in our region that are intertied, and that's Stebbins and St. Michael. And you can see on the map in front of you that the majority of these utilities, 11 of them, are part of AVEC. And then we also have standalone utilities, which are marked out in the green dots. And we do have a little bit of wind infrastructure throughout our region as well. And then I also have marked out a future utility on the map in purple near the community of Mary's Igloo, and that's the Pilgrim Hot Springs Geothermal Power Plant Project. If you could go to slide 2, please. Thank you. In our region, the power costs range from around 46 cents to 72 cents per kilowatt hour, and that's before the PCE subsidy. I know there's been a lot of talk about PCE today, and I appreciate Representative Edgman mentioning the upgrade to the 750 kilowatt hour allowance for residential customers. That's been a huge, huge bonus for residential utility users. In our region, we also have fuel costs that are very high, up to over $8 a gallon for diesel, over $7 a gallon for gasoline in a lot of our communities. And besides the electricity side of energy, there's the transportation side, which is huge and so important for our rural communities. So we need those diesel bulk fuel facilities to store fuel for our communities and the power plants. In our region, we do have some fuel purchasing programs and subsidy programs that help community members. The Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation has a bulk fuel program, which many of our communities utilize. And they also provide an energy subsidy for our communities once a year, which is very appreciated. And I also want to point out that so many residents are using the LIHEAP program. So that low income energy assistance program is huge. It makes heating bills affordable and reasonable for our community members. And I'll stress PCE yet again, that endowment fund is so important for our region. I did put an example on the slide, such as in Elam. The costs are 26 cents, but if you go over that 750 kilowatt hour allowance and you're like an average US household member and using closer to 900, that means all of a sudden you're paying 72 cents per kilowatt hour and your bill is really expensive. Next slide, please. On slide three, I've listed out some of the challenges in our region. Bulk fuel facilities need improvements across the board. We have need for upgrades, for new bulk fuel, for relocations even. We have aging grid infrastructure throughout our entire region. Lots of new power poles are needed, transformers, communication equipment. And with renewable integration, which so many of our communities are super excited about and want to pursue, that also requires energy storage. You'll see the battery system on the slide there was just installed by Nome Joint Utility System last fall. It's operational, and that allows them to maximize the wind power and potentially a future solar project as well. We have erosion, flooding, extreme weather events, which I'm sure you've heard much about, permafrost thaw as well as threatening infrastructure throughout our region. And I'd also like to point out staff turnover and limited workforce. These are some of the biggest challenges that we face in our communities, and most of the requests that I'm getting through our department is for help in these areas. All right, next slide, please. So all of these challenges, how do we identify what the priorities are? Planning documents are huge. These are so important to our region and our communities. We do have a regional energy plan for the Bering Strait region, but that was done in 2015, so a decade ago. Alaska Energy Authority had a great effort, and I think all the regions in the state were able to do a planning effort, very in-depth with lots of different partners and collaborators, and produce these regional energy plans, which laid out all the priorities and action plans for the next 10 years. But here we are 10 years later, and there's no funding for us to do this effort yet again. So we're seeking funding for that, but it's something that I would encourage you to look at for the state. We also have our SEDS document, which points out energy as a regional priority. And because energy is the backbone of our communities, and without it, we can't have the economic development or infrastructure projects. And also communities and organizations also have their own individual energy plans, such as UNATAC has created an energy plan for geothermal development at Pilgrim Hot Springs. The Village of Solomon has their own renewable energy plan. And Nome Joint Utility System also has their own energy plan for the upcoming projects, such as with the Port of Nome and mining projects happening in our community. Next slide. So some solutions I've recommended here, just speaking from my role in a regional organization that works with many different tribes and communities. Some of the things that are working great, I'm part of the Arctic Energy Ambassador Program, which has been really awesome to connect with people throughout other regions in rural Alaska and urban Alaska, and find out what things are working for them. So that program is great, and I hope it does continue. Fund regional strategic energy planning, as mentioned, that effort in 2015 was huge and a big bonus for our regional communities. Alaska Regional Development Organizations, the ARDRs, are also super important, and there's no current funding to really support those from a state level, even though they're an organization that is required for us to have and to continue developing documents and presenting documents for our regions. The ARDR is a great tool to use for energy development as well. Create a Rural Energy Alaska Task Force, and that has been mentioned before, and that's a great idea. bringing together rural voices from all over the state, sustain and enhance energy assistance programs, promote energy efficiency education, youth through adult. That's a huge focus for our program here at Kawerik, is working with youth in our region and spreading information about how to be more energy efficient and getting people excited about future energy jobs, support grid resilience projects that prevent outages, and protect the PC, the endowment fund. And the last slide is just to say, Koyana, thank you so much for your time today. And this is a beautiful picture of Pilgrim Hot Springs for you to enjoy. Thank you, committee.
Great. Thank you for that presentation. Any questions to start off with?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I probably should have asked this of Mr. Morgan as well, but from your perspective in terms of Alaska Energy Authority's sort of visibility and active role, again, from your perspective, how would you sort of assess that? Are they working closely with you? Are they partners sort of in a strategic way? Is there more that we could do to communicate to them? And I'll go back to my comments earlier where I talked about the bill that we passed last year created for the first time a separate board for Alaska Energy Authority, which they didn't have, you know, up until now. They've shared a board with the Alaska Export Industrial Development Association, AIDA. But, yeah, we'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, thank you for the question. I do interact with Alaska Energy Authority here at Kawerik, and from my perspective, they are involved in community projects related to bulk fuel and communities that are applying to the renewable energy funding effort. But there are a lot of projects that AEA is doing that are focused on the more populated areas of Alaska. So I think there's a lot of room for additional interaction with the rural energy side of things and rural communities. The planning effort is huge. That's something that, although it might not necessarily need that structural part to come from AEA, as in they don't necessarily need to organize and run everything for the planning effort, but allowing a funding mechanism to be there for tribes and communities to take that effort on themselves and do their own energy planning with help from the state might be a good pathway.
And again, through the chair, I asked that because on one of your slides there's a reference to a rural energy task force, and you know, task forces sort of come and go. The governor just had a very extensive energy task force. I think it was 235 pages or whatnot. There was a rural component of that report. Representative Rauscher served on it as a then energy chair. He's not here at the moment. You know, it's an interesting concept to put a rural energy task force together, but just having served on the seafood task force, my experience, and I just want to be honest about this, is that a task force has to be targeted, it has to be limited, and it has to have an end goal in mind. Otherwise, really, there is just, you know, a lot to sit around and talk about. And like you pointed out a moment ago, a good part of it comes down to funding, right? If we don't have the funding, it's really hard to get stuff done. And so I put that out there just to be sort of honest about things.
Great.
Oh, and Andrew was CEO Andrew Guy was also on the task force, we did have good role presence on the task force.
Right. Thanks for that. You know, the the governor's energy security task force, as I understand it, took a large bite out of many of the issues, but was, I don't think, seen in the end as being the end, that additional work, perhaps future task force activities might be needed to build on that. And I think the discussion we're having highlights the opportunity, perhaps, that there could be the next version of it that builds on the previous one. to focus more on the rural one, particularly because we have so many different streams of funding and challenges that really, I think, create an opportunity to understand how do we take the money we're going to spend if we don't change our trajectory. We're going to keep spending to maintain the bulk fuel tanks, and we're going to keep spending money to maintain the generators. Meanwhile, we're trying to find money to put in wind farms and solar panels and batteries, and there's just so much money, and trying to maintain these dual paths. Somehow we've got to think our way through how do we actually move out of the box we've built for ourselves. So a task force that might be, if we could design it to have that directed outcome, might be helpful.
Yeah. Co-Chair Helen, I believe there's also some work that we can be doing in the interim towards these goals. We spend more time out of Juneau than in Juneau.
Yeah. Good point. Did you have a comment, sir? Mr. Guy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you don't mind coming back up to the table so you could speak into the microphone, put yourself back on the record, please, so that we...
Andrew Guy with Telstra Corporation.
Thank you, sir.
Regarding the Alaska Energy Authority and rural discussion, you know, the Alaska Energy Authority has a purpose already to plan and develop and maintain a rail belt intertie system, but there's not a corresponding for rural Alaska. I think that's a solution that can be easily implemented. The entities there, it already has a purpose that it's been working on for many years, so it's really maybe expert in it. It just needs to be redirected toward the rural Alaska part of it too now. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for those comments. Representative Costello, did you have a question? You kind of looked like you had a question.
I have a question.
Please.
And thank you very much. Really appreciate the opportunity to have this presentation today. Earlier in session, I had an individual come to me from a rural community, and they were asking for funding for a project that would help with their energy costs. And they alerted me to, in the Power Cost Equalization Statute 4245.180 under grants for utility improvements, it says here that grants can be offered for small power projects, meaning a new or modified project that will either generate, store, or conserve no more than 1.5 megawatts of power or provide a metering system, transmission system, distribution system, or bulk fuel storage facility that has an estimated cost of less than $3 million. And I was curious if as the co-chairs of this committee, if you could provide the committee with perhaps a history of what utility improvements have been funded through this grant program in our recent past, and if that's something that we could learn more about, because it was brought to my attention, and I thought it was worthy of us to look at.
Great. Thanks for that request. I don't have any specific quick answer on that. It sounds like something would be useful to bring up, but Co-Chair Mears, do you have any knowledge of that, or otherwise we'll dig into it?
Yeah, through the chair, I believe we do need to dig more into that. Is that not REF? Separate.
I can show you the statute.
Yeah. Let's dig into that and see if that need is being met through the REF, or it's a separate task.
Representative.
Yeah. So in 2016, Senator Hoffman taking the lead, we passed a bill that created a waterfall sort of impact of the earnings from the PC Endowment mm-hmm. Fund. With the highest priority going to the power cost equalization fund itself. In this current year, it's at $48 million, which is really interesting because it reflects that increase from 500 to 750 kWh, but also the fact that the floor, the base rate between Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau has been in increasing. And it was just a handful of years ago that $48 million was $32 million. I mean, it's really come up quite a bit. But that waterfall effect in the 2016 legislation, Senate Bill 196, creates PC first, community assistance second, if there's the surplus funds, then lastly, a bevy of energy projects that I think tie into this utility portion of the statutes. But to my memory, Alaska Energy Authority has never really in a substantially funded any of those. Mm-hmm. But I think it bears wording, and it's appreciate you pointing that out, Representative Costello, to look into it and find out exactly what happened, because I don't really know much of anything happened to that.
Good. Representative?
Through the chair, and I believe also the last couple of years that waterfall has just taken care of PCE and not been able to fund community assistance program, much less anything else that came after that.
I wanted to go back to Ms. Tordal, if she's still there. I think the discussion you had, I think, outlined a lot of issues in the region. One of the things that has come up in your presentation and the other presentations tangentially has been the economic development impact of energy costs. And you brought up the ARDRs and the need to support those energy plans and the ARDR planning process. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more or dive a little more about how the energy structure and the cost right now is affecting the ability of local businesses to be created, to be sustained, and what impact it's having on just the sustainability of the communities at this point in time. I suspect that this is a real challenge, particularly as we learned with Antioch, where the cost of energy, I cannot imagine somebody trying to run a business in a community like that with the cost of energy and without, of course, the PCE being able to help and offset that. It seems like it'd be impossible to have a local private economy function at that point. But is Tordal, I wonder if you might expand on that a little bit in terms of your view of the energy issue as it relates to creating sustainable rural economies.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think energy is the backbone to all the communities in our region and all of rural Alaska and all of Alaska. And without reliable power and affordable power, it's impossible for new businesses to get up off the ground and start operating. And that's not just the electricity cost, which when it's high, like in Antioch, that's nearly impossible to sustain, but also the cost of fuel, diesel, and gasoline, depending what your business is. If you're a small business owner who's trying to do cultural tourism or take people on fishing tours, you can't do that when the cost of gasoline is prohibited. And the electricity rates are the same. I think there's some interesting overlap with economic development and the PCE program, and a lot of tribes are doing new projects with the independent power producer model that utilize PCE structure and also create an economic development mechanism for the tribe and community. So that's pretty interesting to look at. So I would urge you to look more into that opportunity and be cautious about any PCE work so it doesn't affect those type of models that are already going into play, like in the Northwest Arctic Borough.
Great. Thank you for that. The other piece that I wanted to bring up, following up on that question, is in the case of, I believe, in the Quark area, you've got potentially some new mining and resource development. Graphite one, of course, is the one that's been in the news a lot lately. And, of course, in the Chulista area, we're looking at the Donlin project. And I'm wondering what the prospects are for us to think about how we might help or view these natural resource development projects, particularly as they may be in minerals, helping with the energy infrastructure in an area and helping with development of the large base load that might enable us to reduce the cost or to somehow layer in the development of infrastructure that would benefit the communities in the area. And how are you looking at that in the Quark area? And is that a factor or a tool that you're looking at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mining and critical minerals production is a large discussion in our region right now. There's people on both sides of the spectrum when it comes to this topic. It is a little beyond my scope, but I can speak to what I know of. And for instance, in Nome area and the Pilgrim Hot Springs project, the Graphite One project is very close to the geothermal resource. So if UNATOC chooses to partner with that organization, there's some potential there. There are other projects in the region that are very opposed by communities, so I won't speak to any of those. But I think there is some potential there for collaboration, depending where the projects are. If they're close to communities where infrastructure could be developed to support a natural resource development project, then it could improve the infrastructure transmission and reliability for those communities as well as create job opportunities. But that's about my limited knowledge of that area.
That's great. Thank you for that response. Are there any other questions here from the committee or Mr. Guy, or Mr. Morgan, any final comments you might have that you'd like to add into what we were just discussing on the economic development portion of this? Going once, going twice? Wonderful. Good. Well, thank you for the discussion. Thank you to all of our presenters who have been here today to share the community perspective of these issues, to move us beyond just production and transmission. We've put a little more of a community focus on these issues, but I think also highlighted some important opportunities with the rural energy oversight and the planning that might be important to bring us or put a new lens on some of that. So I appreciate everyone's time today. Committee meeting that we have on Thursday is canceled. We won't have one on Thursday. We'll begin again next Tuesday at 1 p.m. I do want to highlight for the members, as well as others that are following this committee, that we did introduce through the floor yesterday a renewable portfolio standard bill. Our intent is to be bringing that forward, so I would encourage committee members to start having a look at that, to become familiar with it, to let us know what questions you might have that we should be working on as we start planning some presentations to help. This has got a long history. All of this bill has some substantial changes from the past, so I encourage you to look at it with a fresh lens of what's in this, but also what's not in this. As we begin this process, and we'll be looking forward to having some more discussions to unwrap this. But looking forward to the discussions. We've had a lot of meetings over the last couple months of laying the groundwork for these issues, and as we start moving into a couple bills, I think it'll be an interesting transition for this committee. So I appreciate people's time today, and I look forward to the time with you again next week. So thank you very much. We are now adjourned at looks like 2:36. Thank you, and have a good afternoon.
I'll keep my lens.